battle to bad men near and far. He conquered fear and he conquered hate. He turned dark night into day. He made his blazing saddle a torch to light the way. When outlaws rule the West and fear filled the land, a cry went up for a man with guts to take the West in hand. They needed a man who was brave and true, with justice for all as his aim. Then out of the sun rode a man with a gun, and Bart was his name. Yes, Bart was his name. He rode a blazing saddle, he wore a shining star. His job to offer battle to bad men near and far. He conquered fear and he conquered hate. He turned dark night into day. He made his blazing saddle a torch to light the way.
Blazing Saddles, Blazing Saddles. Its first name was Tex-Ex. It was a little kind of précis or story outline written by Andrew Bergman. Andy Bergman, who went on to do Honeymoon in Las Vegas, and recently he did Striptease. He's a very talented guy. It all started with me walking the streets of New York, looking in the gutter, hoping to find some change. I had made two movies back to back. The first one was called The Producers. It got a lousy review in the New York Times. Renata Adler really took me to task for making such a what she called such a stupid collegiate black comedy or something. I don't know. The movie didn't make any money, but it ran a long time. It didn't make any money because it ran in art houses and a few theaters in a few cities, maybe Chicago and New York. And I don't think it ever got below the Mason-Dixon line. I don't think anybody in Texas has ever heard of The Producers. After The Producers, I went to Yugoslavia and I made a movie called The 12 Chairs, based on a book by Ilfan Petrov, two wonderfully talented Russian writers who were having fun with this new experiment called communism back then in 1921 or so, or 23. I had written a screenplay called Marriage is a Dirty Rotten Fraud. I couldn't get it off the ground. I was out of work. I was looking for my next project. I was around, let's see, 59th Street near 5th Avenue, and I heard a voice say, "Mel, Mel," then louder, "Mel," and it was the late, great David Beagleman, who had just created an agency. When MCA had a breakup, he and Freddie Fields created CMA. I didn't have an agent, but David was an old friend, and he knew me, and he said, "What are you doing? You're looking down." I said, "I'm looking for change. Things haven't been going well." So he said, "Have you had lunch?" And I said, "No, not really." And he took me, there was a place called Raffles, I think, or something in the bottom of the Sherry Netherland. It was a nice, like kind of an inn little restaurant brasserie. And I got some scrambled eggs and sliced tomatoes and rye toast. And I was having butter in those days, so I toasted the rye toast with butter. And he said, "Richard Zanuck and David Brown have a company, and they've got a property, an outline, kind of a rough screenplay version of a Western called Tex-Ex. And they sent it to me, and they don't know what to do with it." And the minute I read it, I said, "This is kind of a Mel Brooksian insanity, and I'd love for you to come back to the office with me and read it. It's only about 30, 40 pages. It won't take a long time." So I I went back with him. I read it and I said, you know, I don't do things that I don't write, but this is very funny. He said, so write it. I said, well, it's already written. He said, no, this is just a skeletal outline. It's a profile of what it can be. You got to, you know, it needs bones and flesh and all kinds of. So I said, let me take it home. I took it home. I let my new wife, Ann Bancroft, read it. She loved the idea. And I said, Tex X, that's a cute title. I like that title, Tex X. You know, Malcolm X, Tex X, black guy. Okay. I read it. I liked it. And I said to Bingelman, I said, David, I want to work with the original writer because I like writers. I'm a writer myself. I want to work with this guy, Andy Bergman. And I want to meet with him right away. And to see whether this, and I said, I kind of think that this should be done like we did the show of shows, 5, 6 years ago, 10 years ago, whatever, where just a gang of us got together and we just, whoever had an idea, we'd all run with it and help it, pep it up. So I met with Bergman and I told Bergman, how do you like to work this thing with me? And then we hire some other writers, I have some in mind, and we all sit in a room and we write the screenplay together. He said, gee, that would be wonderful. He thought the producers was great. He was honored. You know, this was his first screenplay. And he said, usually when somebody buys something from the screenwriter, they just toss it away. You know, he's gone, you know. And they just use some of the bare bones. And that's the end of the screenwriter. I said, no, we'll do, you know, I want you all the way on this. So we talked about, we needed a good black writer. A guy that allowed us to do black comedy, you know, literally black comedy. And I suggested Richie Pryor, and he said, well, he's a little nuts, isn't he? And I said, well, Richie was then just a stand-up comic working in a couple of clubs, and he wasn't that well known. But I was a big fan, and I knew how bright he was. And so I called Richie, and he was working in Chicago, and I said, well, fly in. And he said, well, I'll take the train. I don't like to fly. And he said, if you, I like a certain kind of brandy, and have it there, please, for me. So, I don't know what, I think it was Remy Martin. Yeah, VSOP, Remy Martin. And he said, I can get more of it into me on the train before I meet you guys. So I said, okay, take the train. And then I'd just been in a chock full of nuts, and a guy came up to me and just was raving about the producers. And I said, what do you do? He said, I'm a young lawyer, and I want to be a young screenwriter, and I want to give up being a lawyer. And he said, I'm working with a dentist. I said, on your teeth or on a script or what? You know, he said, no, the guy is a comedy writer, and we're a team. So I'm talking about Norman Steinberg, who went on to write My Favorite Year with me. And then his writing partner was a guy by the name of Alan Uger. So I told Andy about the dentist and Norman, and I said, I have a feeling that these guys are good. So we all sat in a room, and it was chaos. I mean, Richie Pryor wrote most of Mongo, and I wrote most of The Black Sheriff. It was a crazy mix, but a good mix. And we'd write 3 or 4 hours, and then we'd all have to go to a separate place and kind of chill out and cool it. And then we'd come back and we could take each other again. We were writing in some building that Warner Brothers had. I think it was 666 Fifth Avenue. And on the sixth floor, everything was six. I think I was afraid of getting it stitched into my scalp later because of the omen. I was afraid we were doomed. But anyway, we got up there, we wrote, we carried on, and we kept in touch with John Kelly, who was running production for Warner Brothers in those years. And he said, Tex X, no good, sounds like a black exploitation film. Tex, don't, sounds only for a black audience. So I said, okay, Western, and a black guy is the sheriff. I came up with a title that I thought was great, Black Bart. Because that was the guy's name, the sheriff's name. I called him Bart. And couldn't get that past the board at Warner Brothers. They didn't like the title, Black Bart. Well, we kept writing, we kept changing things, and I came up with a kind of a nifty, kind of weird title that I liked. Nobody else liked it, called The Purple Sage, because you know, if the guy was really black, you know, and he was very wise, and Purple Sage is a great old Zane Grey, I think, Western. So, and no, he said that's too arcane, that's too wild. Purple Sage, nobody, ain't nobody gonna know Purple Sage. And then we kept writing, and we left the title alone. We just didn't bother with the title. We just kept polishing up people like the Johnsons, you know, Howard Johnson, and who died that year that we were writing it. I think it was 72. And my son was born, Maximilian Brooks. Max Brooks was born in 72, and that's one of the reasons I took the job. I needed some money. But like Dickens, who took a job writing for a magazine, he wrote A Christmas Carol for a London magazine. He said to a friend, "I'd better make this the best thing I've ever written, because it's obvious I'm writing it for commercial need and purpose, you know." I said, "This better be the best movie I ever wrote, because I want to make sure that, you know, that people don't think I'm selling out." Here I wrote The 12 Chairs, and I wrote The Producers, and up to that time, everything was like on a very hot, lofty level, I thought, of writing. So anyway, Richard peeled off. He had some gigs, and he had to work. Uger had to get back to dentistry to make a living, because the money we gave him ran out. I think the whole thing, the whole movie cost about $2,600,000. 2.6 to do this amazing Western. Nobody got any money. There were no stars. There was no above the line. We got hardly anything to write it, and I got hardly anything to direct it. I think I got $50,000 all in for writing, for directing, and for sweeping up. It was okay. I was doing what I wanted to do. So anyway, Steinberg held in there, Bergman held in there, and Brooks held in there, and so we'd finish working at my apartment, and then we would walk. I lived in the village. We'd walk all the way from the village to Chinatown. And, like, at midnight, we'd have beef and broccoli with pan-fried noodles. We loved that. And we'd have that and a Pepsi at 12. And on the way there and on the way back, I had a little notepad, and every time we'd say something about Black Bart or, you know, or Mongo or something, I'd make a little note. We'd work hard, and then we'd walk on these hot summer nights. I remember Max was born in May, and we had to write in June and July to finish it. We had to deliver it by the end of July in 72. I got out here, and there was a problem. I had to get my wife and baby out here. So I did. I saw a house on Rising Glen, which is off Sunset Boulevard, which is in kind of West Hollywood. And instead of renting, I bought it, because in those days you could put a little bit down, and I figured my per diem. So between my per diem, living out here, a couple of hundred a day, whatever it was, or $100 a day, so I ate beans like they did in Blazing Saddles, and I just kept paying this house off, and we had a place to live on Rising Glen. It's still there. And there was a nice German Shepherd that lived next door that was owned by Janice Page, a great singer and good little actress. And the dog's name was Jenny. And to this day, my son, who's going to be 25, says, "I wonder what ever happened to Jenny," you know. So those were good days. And I went to Warner Brothers every day, and I rented a green a Buick, and that little green Buick used to take me there every day. And I got Steinberg and Andy Bergman, to come out, and we did a little extra work, polished it up. And we had things that were really scary, like the farting scene. Could we do that? I mean, talk about political. We didn't even know the word politically correct or incorrect. There was no such word. But we knew that a lot of farts have never been done in a movie. I'll never forget, I went up to John Kelly's office, and I said, "John, you've said nothing about this. But we're a little worried about this farting scene, about the audience turning them off and, you know, and really making the movie just a weird little movie instead of a people's movie." He said, I'll never forget what he said. He said, Mel, if you're going to go up to the bell, ring it. I said, okay, John. I said, there's three or four other things, like knocking a horse out and, you know. And Lily von Stupp, alone with this black sheriff, you know. It's true, you know. So anyway, we said, that's the script. We're going to literally make the script. And it was a raw, crazy, anarchic, insane script. But we all loved it. We're gonna do it. And I had John Kelly's blessing to go all the way, and so I went all the way. Okay, casting. I wanted Richie Pryor to play the Black Sheriff. So John wasn't against it, but the other people who were running Warners at the time thought that that wasn't such a good idea because he was like a known sniffer. But he was the most God-blessed with talent guy I ever saw in my life. And I knew that the camera would love him and there was a sweetness in Richard Pryor that was undeniable, inevitable. You'd have to love that guy. And I said, that's the Black Sheriff. And I went on bended knee to every studio executive, every single one of them. I even flew to New York, back to New York, where the money was, and I begged for him. And they wouldn't give him to me. So we started casting. And the minute I saw Cleavon Little, I said, that's the guy. He hadn't done a movie. He was a Broadway actor. By the time I got him, he was off, not on Broadway, but I read all his reviews and stuff, and asked everybody who'd ever worked with him in New York about this guy, and they were crazy about him. They thought that he was really, an up-and-coming, really huge talent. So there, Cleavon Little, I met him, I loved him, I kissed him right away. I said, this is a good guy, this guy's going to be good, he gets it. And he has a sly, sweet way of delivering his lines that just the way I wanted Black Bart to deliver the line. Because, you know, he's in heaven now, and he belongs in heaven. He's such a dear, bright, sweet guy, and he was just so talented. He was just so perfectly talented. So if I couldn't get Richard Pryor, God was good to me. We got Cleavon Little. The other casting went very smoothly. I signed Madeline Kahn, and she was, where did I get Madeline Kahn? She was in, Bogdanovich had done a movie called Paper Moon, I think. Paper Moon. And then there was, she was just great. I just loved her. And I knew how funny she was from off-Broadway. And she sang a Sheldon Harnick tune called Garbage that just knocked me out. She was just so great. And she auditioned for me, and I said, let me see your legs. And she said, oh, you're that kind of guy. I said, hey, I'm okay. I'm happily married. I really don't fool around. And she was nervous. I said, let me see your legs. She said, why? I said, because I know you can do Dietrich, but you got to have the legs because you're going to straddle the chair and you're going to, you know. So she showed me her legs. I said, they're gorgeous. They're great. You know, I was so happy. She said, you're not going to touch them. No, no. And I never did. And she's one of the most talented people that ever lived. I mean, either in one stand-up comedy or acting or whatever you want. You can't beat Madeline Kahn. She's the best. And I knew I'd have fun with her on the set. That she'd just giggle and laugh and keep everybody happy and, you know, so good-natured. So then there was a director. His name was Claude E. Starrett Jr. And he did an impression for me once in the commissary of Gabby Hayes. Hey, Carl, he's all grizzled old. And I called him. I said, well, do Gabby Hayes in the movie? He said, sure. So he did it. He was great. And I got John Hillerman to be one of the Johnsons. He was Howard Johnson. And he later became famous with Magnum P.I. on that show. You know, he was the sidekick. Slim Pickens. after I'd seen Slim Pickens in Stanley Kubrick's Dr. Strangelove, you know, riding on that bomb down to Earth. This guy is thrilling. He's thrilling. So, what a cast. David Huddleston was Olson Johnson, and I got Liam Dunn from, he was a judge in a movie, a Warner Brothers movie. He's dead now, Liam Dunn. He had emphysema. But we were doing a movie called Silent Movie. He was a newspaper guy. He had a newspaper stand, and we kept hitting him with the newspapers, you know. He never caught the bundles. He just smashed them down to the ground. Fake newspapers. He never got hurt. But after every scene, we'd say, do you want water? Do you want some orange juice? Or do you want a cigarette? He'd say cigarette, you know. And so he'd have a few puffs of cigarette. He'd have a few puffs of oxygen. It was weird. It was just, the guy was weird. And then we got this football player, Alex Karras, who was very good. He auditioned for Mongo, and I said, you got it. You know, he was amazing. Oh, he just got it. He was so great. And then George Firth, who was a playwright, played Van Johnson, and he said, can I wear red socks? And I said, why? He said, because don't you know Van Johnson always wears red socks? I said, okay, wear red socks. Dom DeLuise was... played Buddy Bizarre, and his wife, Carol Arthur, played Harriet Johnson, the school mom who punches a lot of people, you know, bad guys. Now I had to get the Waco Kid, the second most important character. So where was I going to get the Waco Kid? So when I was writing it in New York, I was very close to Gene Wilder, and Gene, I kept letting him read it. I said, you're too young. You can't play the Waco Kid. I need an old alky, a guy with lines in his face. You know, an old man. So Gene said, I could do it. I tell you, I could do it. I love this guy. I could do it. I said, no, you can't do it. So he wouldn't back down. Anyway, I said, we'll work again on something else, Gene. But Blazing Saddles is not, and we did. Right after Blazing Saddles, we worked on Young Frankenstein, which was a miracle. But he never got mad at me, and we were really good friends. Such good friends, he named his company Pall Mall Productions. Anyway, Dan Daly was my choice. Strange choice, but I thought leather-faced, big heart. I knew, I heard from people he was the best writer in the world, of any actor except the cowboy actors. Except the, you know, the Slim Pickens, who was in the movie, those kind of guys, and Ben Johnson. Ben Johnson and Slim Pickens were the best writers in the world. But for civilian, you know, Dan Daly was a song and dance man and a great actor. He was the best horse rider. He could do anything with a horse. He raised horses. He loved horses. And I got him in Hawaii, and I said, come on. He said he read it, and he said, I love it. He said, it's so crazy and so touching, and I love it. He said, let me think. Then he called me back, and he said, I'm blind. I can't see. It'd be dangerous. I'm wearing Coke bottles for glasses. And he died about a year later. I mean, he never, you know. He said, I can't do it. He said, but I love it. I asked John Wayne at the commissary. I gave it to him, and he read it. He saw me the next day. He said, I'll meet you here 12 noon. He's a crazy guy, John Wayne. He said, I'll meet you here tomorrow, 12 noon, same table. I'll read this overnight. And he read it, and he said, I can't do this. This is too dirty. I'm John Wayne. He said, I can't do this. He said, but man, he said, I was up all night screaming, laughing. He said, I'm going to be the first one online to see this movie. I'm going to get you a big audience. He said, but I can't do it. I kissed him and said, thanks. And then I saw it, and I had seen a movie called They Shoot Horses, Don't They? And I saw Gig Young, and I said, he is an alky. Great. I got an old alky. You know, I got the guy. So I assigned Gig Young to play the Waco Kid. Let's see. Then we started to shoot the movie on a Friday. Oh, by the way, I came out of a shower that the kind of the day before we were going to shoot on Thursday morning, and I said to my wife, I got it, Blazing Saddles. She says, it doesn't make any sense. She says, it's senseless, Blazing Saddles. I said, no, it's senseless, but it says Western and it says crazy. It also has a little heat in the saddle, you know. Saddle can mean your saddle, its saddle, you know. Blazing Saddles. So blazing, I said, is a good word. So she said, okay, try it on. I called Callie. He said, I love it. I called Bergman. I called everybody, all the writers. They loved it. So I said, that's it, Blazing Saddles. Anyway, we started shooting. Kid Young in a jail cell meets Cleavon Little for the first time because he's brought in drunk and he doesn't know where he is. And then he wakes up upside down. And the first thing he says is, are we awake? Says Cleavon Little, and he says, are we black? You know, he's not sure. And they have this upside down, so we draped Gig Young's legs over the bed and hung him upside down. And he started to talk, and then he started shaking. I said, boy, this guy's giving me a lot. He is giving me plenty. He's giving me the old Alky shake, you know, great. And then it got serious because the shaking never stopped and green stuff started spewing out of his mouth and nose and he started screaming and I said, that's the last time I'll ever really cast anybody who is that person. You know, if you want an alcoholic, don't cast an alcoholic. You know? Cast somebody who can play and maybe an actor who can play an alcoholic. Anyway, poor Gig Young. There it was, first shot on Friday, 8 in the morning, 9 in the morning, ambulance came, took him away. No movie, have no movie, no Blazing Saddles. I stopped production Friday at noon. I said, we're in for a day, whatever a day costs, $30,000, $20,000, that's the day, go home. Everybody go home, we have to think. I called Gene Wilder in New York, I told him what happened. So he said, green? He was, why was it green? I said, I don't know. It was green. You know? And he said, what time is it there? He says, it's 3 o'clock. I said, it's noon. He said, okay, I'll be out tomorrow morning. He looked at he called somebody there. He says, there's a flight. There's a night flight. He says, I'll be out tomorrow morning. He says, we'll go over the costumes tomorrow. He says, I got the script. I kept sending him the script because he's my pal. I kept sending him updated versions of the script. So he said, I'll read Jim. I'll have it on the plane. I'll have it. He said, what is it? Scene so-and-so in the jail? I'll have it. Okay. So I said, do you want to rehearse? He said, no. We'll do it. You just set it up for Monday morning. And I did. He came out. Saturday, there he was. We got him outfitted. We worked on his hair and, you know, how Western long. And we got him a horse. On Sunday, he rode the horse all day Sunday to get used to the horse, and he was pretty good to be his pal. Monday morning, 8 o'clock, he was hung up upside down. We only lost a half a day, you know, because I'd covered with Cleavon the other half of that day. Everything on Cleavon, close-ups, his entrance, you know, I just couldn't use the guy hanging upside down because it was the wrong guy. So I put Gene in, and there we were. We were never even a half a day behind. Gene just hooked his boots, hung down, and said, are we black? And then he went on, and he saved my life. Because he's, you know, he's not only a genius actor, but he's a good friend. And he never said, I told you so, or, you know. And then when he came with a four-page outline that he'd written for Young Frankenstein, I just said, of course, whatever, let's do it. We sat down. Actually, while I was editing Blazing Saddles, we were holed up at the Bel Air Hotel where he was staying, working on another movie called The Little Prince. So they put him up there, so he made tea, Earl Grey tea, every night with a little bit of milk we had. Like the English had it, with some brown sugar, and digestive biscuits. He always had a tin of these digestives, which were kind of graham crackery like, and they were very nice, round and nice. And we'd write and eat our biscuits and write this Young Frankenstein, and we knew right away that should be in black and white, etc. And anyway, Gene was very helpful during the making of Blazing Saddles. He loved Madeline. Madeline loved him, and they were pals instantly. And he glued everything together. And Cleavon said, I couldn't have found a better guy, because Gene was a fine actor and helped Cleavon over some little rough stuff, you know, where he needed more intensity. And I'll never forget, he put his arm around Cleavon. Cleavon goes over. He's walking down the street. And he says, good morning, ma'am, to a little old lady, a sweet little old lady, you know, with a bonnet. He says, good morning, ma'am. She says, up yours, nigger. He stops. He takes that. It's like a knife in his heart. You know, just can't believe it. You know, all he said was good morning to this little old lady. And he comes into the jail, and his head is down. And Gene comes in. He says, what's the matter? And he tells him what happened. And he said, well, you can't blame these people. These are, you know... This is a soil, a common clay of the New West. These are simple, honest people. You know, morons. You know? And his timing on morons was just, that's the biggest laugh in the movie. Harvey Korman. Harvey Korman, as the lieutenant governor, was the slimiest. He was hysterical. And his suffering of Taggart, of Slim Pickens, when Harvey said... we've got to do something. We are transient nodes of a cosmic force. You know, he did this, all this kind of Nietzsche and Kant and wild talk. And when he finished his speech, Slim Pickett said, ditto. And Harvey said, ditto? Ditto, you provincial putz, he yelled it. So I think Harvey came up with some incredibly funny things, you know. We were sued by Hedy Lamarr for using Harvey's name, Hedy Lamarr. And we settled it out of court. I think it wasn't a lot. It was a couple of $1,000, and she was happy. But I apologized personally for almost using her name. I don't think she got the joke. I said, I'm sorry for almost using your name. Because we said Hedy Lamarr. And then I think the high points of the movie are Madeleine Kahn doing Lily von Stupp doing the Marlene Dietrich character. I mean, that's where the movie leaves being a normal comedy and becomes something otherworldly. It's just out of this world, literally. I mean, it reaches a whole other level of comedy. Because she's really doing, Marlene Dietrich. She's doing that character. And her take, I mean, she really becomes that German. She's looking at these cowboys and these rustic characters. Her take on everything is so brilliant. And so anyway, I just really loved working with this cast. I loved it. I loved directing that movie. Because it was such a crazy movie, I could do anything I wanted. We had, instead of background music, there was one point I wanted foreground music. It had never been done. I wanted Count Basie to actually be on the desert and have the horse, you know, just trot past him and just see that. You'd hear this great, you'd see Cleavon Little on a palomino dressed like Roy Rogers at his height. And then you'd hear April in Paris from the Basie organization, big band, which would make it very hip, very juxtaposed to the West, you know, make it really, to give him his music, the sheriff his new music. And then he trots by, and there's Basie, actually out on the desert, and he was. We got Count Basie, we got his whole band, and instead of just, they actually played. Of course, we had to get their original recording of April in Paris, but, I mean, they played out on the desert anyway. They were just sensational. Count Basie was the sweetest guy that ever lived. Burton Gilliam was Taggart's assistant. He was Slim Pickens' assistant. And he was so funny when the guys were singing, I Get No Kick From... He wanted them to sing an old nigger work song. You know, good natured. Give us an old nigger work song, you know, like on the levee or down in the cotton field. And suddenly, Cleavon Little leads them into I get no kick from champagne. I mean, it's Cole Porter. They're singing, they're doing Cole Porter, and this guy, these cowboys, and Burton Gilliam sold that joke just by his eyes shifting around like, what the hell am I hearing, you know? That was so beautiful. So I got to thank Burton Gilliam for that. And Dom DeLuise was so funny. In that whole scene of suddenly there's a bunch of gay dancers working on a set doing a Busby Berkeley kind of number, and the cowboys come crashing through the wall, and then they tangle it up, mix it up, and of course one of the cowboys falls in love with one of the dancers. They make a date, and it's just it's the weirdest thing. And I used it just so I could pull back from that stage, whatever it is, 14, and pull way back and show you that this was a movie. I mean, it was like Pirandello. Okay, so we make this movie, we finish it, and by the way, there are some people that I should mention. John Chulay was my first assistant director, who taught me about Hollywood. He got me through it. There was a lot of tough shooting, and he really broke that board down and told me how to chew it up and digest it and shoot it and eat it up, so that I wouldn't run myself into the ground. The choreography, we did a number called I'm Tired, and in the number there were Germans with pointy hats and helmets, and Alan Johnson did that. He also did Springtime for Hitler for me, for the producers. So just recently in Dracula, he just did some wonderful stuff for me with Leslie Nielsen, who's not easy to turn into a dancer, but he did it. There's a production designer whose name is Peter Woolley. Little guy, blonde hair, now it's probably gray, and short, cute, adorable. Didn't cost me a penny, not in time or materials. Designed everything, every picture he put down in front of me was perfect. Byrock was the director of photography, Joe Byrock, great guy. He said, why are you asking me all these personal questions? I said, I like to know about people. This year, Joe Byrock died. He was about 80 when he made this movie. He must have been 100. He must have died at 100. Well, I'll tell you, he was literally in his early 70s when he made Blazing Saddles. Two cameras on everything. Everything cut together. Since that was my first Hollywood movie, and I've always used two cameras. In New York, I only used one camera. But since I got out here, and ever since. Byrock was great. John Howard was my film editor. He edited most of my films up until High Anxiety. And he was wonderful. And he had worked on some very important movies and learned a lot about... I think he worked on Butch Cassidy and The Sundance Kid. And so he knew a lot about editing that I didn't know. I didn't know a thing about editing compared to his ways of getting around things and making things work. And he came to the set real early and said, just get a close-up in every scene. Just get a close-up. I don't care if it's of a clock. I don't care if it's a rat in the corner. I don't care if it's somebody's face. I don't care if it's a smoldering cigarette. Give me a close-up of anything. He says, don't worry about the scene. I'll cut it together. And he did. He never missed. The guy was a genius. I'll never forget when I was doing Silent Movie, John C. Howard said, take a close-up of that coffee cup on the table shaking when Dom DeLuise is doing a flamenco dance. Just give me that. And because of that, he saved the whole scene. So, these guys saved my life. I used a sound guy. Sound set was Gene Cantamessa. He was wonderful. Never had to do looping a little bit, tiny bit. Even shooting outdoors with up in Palmdale and up in the desert, winds blowing. He'd shield the mics. He was just, Gene Cantamessa was wonderful. And there was a script supervisor who was very talented called Julie Pitcannon. And ending up working for Barry Levinson, who I brought into my... camp when I first did Silent Movie and then High Anxiety as a writer, actor, and now Julie Pitcannon is working for this great director, Barry Levinson. I had a composer on that movie called John Morris, John Morris started with me on The Producers and did 12 Chairs. And naturally, I brought him out, and he did a great... He was nominated. We both were for an Academy Award for this title song, Blazing Saddles. I like to write music, so I actually wrote I'm Tired for Lillie von Stupp for Madeleine Kahn. I did that. And I wrote The French Mistake for Dom DeLuise. Crazy song. Frankie Lane sang for us. He sang Blazing Saddles. And he sang it with all his heart. He didn't know we were making a comedy. He knew we were making a Western. He sings these Western songs. So John Morris says to me, Mel, should we tell him? I mean, he's singing his heart out. I said, no, I think it's good for the movie. I think it works with the whip cracks and all of that craziness, you know? He rode a blazing saddle. He wore a shining star. I mean, with vibrato, whatever. I said, let him sing it. Let him sing it. Yeah, he did. And he never knew. He never knew. And you know, he just... And I realized, I learned something from that. I said, you know, absurd situation, play straight. Actor, play straight. A situation, absurd, comedy. And I never forgot that. The minute I saw him singing that with his eyes, with tears in his eyes, he believed in this sheriff cleaning up Rock Ridge or something. I just couldn't believe it. Anyway, he was great. And finally, Michael Hertzberg, who was with me as an AD on The Producers. He was my first assistant director. Great help to me then. He really led me by the collar. He said, no, we're shooting on this set now. You have to go there and direct that. Oh, thank you, Michael. And then he went to Yugoslavia with me to make the 12 chairs. And it cost him a lot, I mean, emotionally, to hang out there for like 9.5 months. And he was my first AD, and he was... I guess one of the producers was Sidney Glazier. Glazier was the producer, so he must have been the co-producer. And then when I did Blazing Saddles, he came out to Hollywood with me, to Warner Brothers, to actually be the producer of Blazing Saddles. And he did a great job. Okay, that was production, post-production. At the end of Blazing Saddles, I was writing Young Frankenstein. That was like in end of 73, beginning of 74. But it was too much. I was starting to switch to minty cigarettes, like Cools and stuff, you know, because my smoking too much. I said, what am I doing? This is crazy. I'll die. I'll die in the middle of Young Frankenstein from smoking. And I quit. And John quit. He quit on the same weekend I quit. I didn't know it, and he didn't know it. We were both smoking too much. From that day, I haven't had a cigarette since. I mean, you know, it's amazing. I may have had a puff or two, but not seriously. I mean, you know, it's been, whatever, 25 years. And then I met Marty Feldman on Young Frankenstein, and Marty Feldman smoked a carton a day. Easily, you know. 10 packs, it didn't mean anything to him. He had a little cigarette lighter hanging around his neck, and he just chain smoked. I mean, to get halfway down, he lighted a new one. All day. I mean, just, he needed a carton a day. We finished Blazing Saddles. I do a kind of rough / fine cut. I show it in a screening room to 12 executives. Everything was in 12, strange 12. 12 was like the 12 apostles, like Jesus. Everything was 12. These 12 guys see it. Pretty crazy picture. They couldn't help laugh at a couple of scenes, the farting scenes, etc., you know? And picture comes to an end. Glorious end. I mean, what a brilliant idea. I put the two cowboys in a caddy limo, and they drive off into the sunset with a chauffeur. I mean, yeah, hey, you know, that's pretty good stuff. Nothing. Quiet. Sitting there, lights come up, quiet. 12 executives. Sitting there with Mike Hertzberg, my producer, just us. And there's Callie, who's for the picture, but the big money is there, and it's pretty rough. For about 10 minutes, it's silent. Nobody talks. I was sitting there 10 minutes. Clearing throats. I think it was Leo Greenfield. Leo Greenfield, I think, was the guy who said, we can play New York, Chicago, and L.A. If we want to open it, we can open it in those three. They'll get it. He said, just the words Luzzum Gain when Mel is the Indian chief, just that will stop this movie from going beyond these three cities. He said, it's very, very narrow. Very funny. There's a couple of things are funny. And I don't know. I don't really know whether we should open this. And then there was a lot of, well, they went back and forth. So Kelly said, no, this is a lot of good stuff here. Why don't we sleep on this before we come to a decision? Let's sleep on this and talk again tomorrow. You know? And he says, well, we can eat it, 2.6. I mean, we can bury it. We can eat it, you know? And there was that kind of talk. They weren't going to release the picture because it was so bizarre, so wild. And it didn't pay to open the advertising monies on top of it. It would be a lot more expensive than the negative, of course. So why throw good money after bad? So I didn't know what to do. Hertzberg said, look, why don't we go to room 12 tonight? 200 seats, 12, all these 12s working for us. And ask the secretaries. You know, so that was 11 in the morning. So we got out, Mimeo things to every office, everybody's office at Warner Brothers, everybody's office. And then we called all our friends. I called Dom DeLuise. I said, get it out to your friends. And we packed it. Instead of 200 people, there were 300 people. People were sitting in the aisles, people were crowding in the back, you know. We play the picture right from the Frankie Lane singing the titles with the Warner Brothers burning away with the arrows, with the whip cracks, with the dock that chink a day's pay for napping on a job. It was thunder. I mean, you never heard last like that in your life. And that little tiny shoebox of a theater, it was screams, yelling. People were running up and down. People were banging each other, smacking each other with laughter, rolling in the aisles. It was incredible. Well, the word got out to the big shots. The next day, I got a call. I was in my shower. It was about 8 o'clock in the morning, and I got a call from Callie. He said, what did you do last night? Why did you invite me? Why don't you tell me? Here, everybody, the lot's jumping. Everybody's jumping up and down. You know, Ashley just called me. What's going on, you know? I said, well, we showed it. We want to see ourselves, you know? I said, we had the first screening of Blazing Saddles for you 12 guys, and I got like 3 laughs. I said, this is ridiculous. I said, you know, I couldn't believe it. So I had to get a regular crowd. Didn't have anything to lose. He said, well, everybody is talking about it. So we are. I'm going to do a pretty good general release. He says, I'm just going to put my job on the line and go out with it and spend maybe $1 million immediately to get it out there. And so we talked about the poster. The poster was a brilliant poster. Blazing Saddles, never give a saga an even break. That was a wonderful, I think Joe Hyams came up with that at Warner Brothers. We bought it immediately. Never give a saga an even break. Of course, you had to know that W.C. Fields had used it in a movie and that it was created by, I think by the great P.T. Barnum, who talked about the circus, his circus, and said, never give a sucker an even break, you know, so. The poster was designed by Anthony Goldschmidt, and it was a very immediate success. Now the T-shirts, I have a few left, are very valuable. I think we actually opened on Wilshire Boulevard. I think we had a screening at the AFCO, and there was a stunt, and they brought horses down Wilshire Boulevard. Cowboys on Horses. It was a great, crazy screening. So we had the screening, and Ted Ashley, who was running Warner Brothers, then corners me and says, okay, Mel, great picture, but you got to do the following. He doesn't know my contract. He doesn't know that I have final cut in my contract. So he says, representing the studio, he says, here's what we have to do. You got to take out the word nigger. You got to take out the... I said, okay, I got a pan. Nigger, out. The bean scene, farting, out. I said, it is out. He said, you've got to take out punching the horse. We can't get away with it. Okay, punching the horse is out. The scene with the Lily von Stupp and the black sheriff, you're sucking my arm or something. He says, you got to take that out, out. I said, great. Otherwise we can't release it. And I said, okay, but they're all out. He left. I crumpled up my paper that I take them all notes, threw them in the waste paper. I never heard another word from him. We opened. It was a success. But, Amy, can you imagine? What if I had not had final cut? They could have insisted. They could have wrecked it like they did on television. I can't watch Blazing Saddles on television. I can watch it on cable. Yeah, it's all in. But I can't watch it on where they cut it. You know, these... A lot of prudes got together and, you know, silly people got together and they cut out everything they thought would be offensive to a four-year-old, you know? So, you know, we've got pap. We've got pablum. I mean, it's nonsense on television. I can't stand it. The movie did pretty well in its first issuance, in its first release. Pretty well. And it did even better in its second release that summer. We came out sometime in the winter, 74. In the winter of 74, and then in the summer of 75, we did even better. It was a re-release. Warner Brothers didn't have a big summer picture, so the theater owners kept clamoring for it. So they made 250 new prints and sent it out over the summer. And we got a lot of letters, a tremendous amount. I got over 1,000 letters from people who, animal lovers, who thought that I actually had Alex Karras as Mongo smash the horse in the face and knock it out with her. He missed it by a foot, and they had these little filaments, monofilament on the, you know, guiding on the horse's legs. All they did was tug it gently, and these horses were brilliant. We had two horses who could do a fall, make it look like they were really knocked out. There was a lot of white people that didn't like the word nigger. Strangely enough, not from blacks, never objected to the word nigger. They knew that it was used correctly in the movie, that the sheriff was subject to this weird, these people who he was helping were against him simply because he was black and they called him nigger. I mean, so it was fine. And I don't think it should be used. I don't think the word should be used. Unless it's used absolutely correctly to show race prejudice. And I didn't show it. I didn't show it from bad people. I showed it from good people who didn't know any better. And it was really understood, I think, you know, by the black community. They got it. They dug it. They were smart. They understood everything. Blazing Saddles is still a big, very big favorite. It made Texas the first movie I ever made. It got to Texas. Everybody in Texas loved it, you know. Kind of strange. Maybe they loved it on both, you know, from both sides. It's a good movie. I'm very proud of it. It just never stopped. To this day, it hasn't stopped. It just keeps getting sold and rented, etc. It's still paying for my beans. In video.
Ain't it a crying shame? I'm so tired. God damn it, I'm exhausted. Hello, cowboy. What's your name?
Tex, ma'am.
Tex, ma'am. Tell me, Tex, ma'am, are you in show business?
Nope.
Well, then why don't you get your friggin' feet off? Hello, handsome. Is that a 10-gallon hat, or are you just enjoying the show? Everything below the waist is kaput.
I'll see you alone in my dressing room right after the show.
Willkommen, bienvenue, welcome, come on in.
Wie geht's, meine Schatzi?
Far out.
For you.
Oh, a red rose. How romantic. Have a seat, Sheriff. Won't you excuse me for a moment while I slip into something a little bit more comfortable?
Bitter, baby.
Oh. Why don't you, loosen your bullets. Ah, I feel refreshed. Isn't it bright in here? There. Isn't that better? Pardon me, I'll be back in a moment. God damn it.
How's it going?
It's like wet sauerkraut in my hands. By morning, he will be my slave.
Splendid. Just let me have a little feel.
Yeah. Where were we? Where are you? Oh yes. Let me sit down next to you. Tell me, Shotzi. Is it true what they say about the way you people are gifted? Oh, it's true. It's true. It's true. It's true. Would you care for another Schnitzelgruben?
No, thank you. 15 is my limit on Schnitzelgruben.
Well, then, how about a little,
Baby, please, I am not from Havana. Excuse me, honey. Besides, I'm late for work. I got some heavy chores to do.
Will I see you later?
Well, it all depends on how much vitamin E I can get my hands on.
Nein, Achtung! Bitte, no, you mustn't go. I need you. I never met nobody like you. I can't live without you. Du hast gemacht mein entire Leben.
Please, you're making a German spectacle of yourself. I'll be the same, baby.
Do. Oh, what a nice guy.
Oh, dearie. Look what the cat dragged in.
Oh. Hey, what's happening in the clean world?
Oh, bad news. I got a writ here for Mongo's release signed by Hedley Lamarr himself.
Hedley Lamarr? Why would a dude like Hedley Lamarr care about Mongo?
It got me.
It's legal. Oh, them snitching groupers can wipe you out. Wake up time! Okay, Mongo. You're free to go.
Mongo, no go.
Oh, come on, Mongo. You're a free man.
Mongo stayed with Sheriff Bart. Sheriff first man ever whipped Mongo. Mongo impressed at the feelings for Sheriff Bart.
Oh, you better watch out, big fella. I think Mongo has taken a little fancy to you.
Oh, Mongo straight.
Listen, Mongo, maybe you know, why is a high roller like Hedley Lamarr interested in Rock Ridge?
Don't know. Got to do with where Choo-Choo go.
Mongo, why would Hedley Lamarr care about where the Choo-Choo go?
Don't know. Mongo only pawn in game of life.
Choo-Choo. I think this might be a good time to mosey out where they're building on the railroad and maybe do a little snooping. Sheriff of Rock Ridge.
Rock Ridge? Hey, the railroad's going through there.
Don't mess up the brother's mind.
Holy mother of pearl. It's that nigger that went and hit me on the head with a shovel. Now, what the hell do you think you're doing with that 10-star, boy?
Watch that boy shit, redneck. You talking to the sheriff of Rock Ridge.
Well, now, if that don't beat all, here we take the good time and trouble to slaughter every last Indian in the West, and for what? So then you appoint a sheriff that's blacker than any Indian. I am depressed.
Excuse me, Mr. Taggart, sir, but I sure do hate to see you like this. What if me and the boys was to shoot that nigger dead? Would that pep you up some?
That might help.
All right, boys. On a count of three.
I wouldn't do that if I were you.
Don't pay no attention to that, Alky. He can't even hold a gun, much less shoot it. Like I said, on a count of three. One. Two. Three.
Well, don't just sit there looking stupid, grasping your hands in pain. How about a little applause for the Waco kid?
All right. I'm through being Mr. Goodbar. The time has come to act, and act quickly. All of my plans have backfired. Instead of the people leaving, they're staying in droves.
Why don't you admit it? He's too much of a man for you, I know. You're gonna need an army to beat him. You're finished. Fertig, verfallen, verlumped, verblunged, verkackt, verfallen of England.
You're a Teutonic twat. I must think. Wait a minute. She said army. Of course. An army of the worst dregs ever to soil the face of the West. Taggart!
Yes, sir?
I've decided to launch an attack that will reduce Rock Ridge to ashes.
What do you want me to do, sir?
I want you to round up every vicious criminal and gunslinger in the West. Take this down. I want rustlers, cutthroats, murderers, bounty hunters, desperados, mugs, pugs, thugs, nitwits, halfwits, dimwits, vipers, snipers, con men, Indian agents, Mexican bandits, muggers, buggerers, bushwhackers, hornswagglers, horse thieves, bull dykes, train robbers, bank robbers, ass kickers, shit kickers, and Methodists!
Could you repeat that, sir?
Where's everybody going?
Read this.
Well, can't you see that's the last act of a desperate man?
We don't care if it's the first act of Henry V. We're leaving.
Now, wait a minute. Wait just one doggone minute here. Just give me 24 hours to come up with a brilliant idea to save our town. Just 24 hours. That's all I ask.
No!
You do it for Randolph Scott.
All right, Sheriff. 24 hours.
I'm going to go to the house.
Next!
Qualifications.
Rape, murder, arson, and rape.
You said rape twice.
I like rape.
He'll do.
Charming. Sign right here. Very good. Badge.
Next!
Qualifications?
Arson, armed robbery, mayhem.
Wait a moment. What have you got in your mouth?
Nothing.
Nothing, eh? Lyle.
Gum.
Chewing gum online, eh? I hope you brought enough for everybody.
I didn't know there was going to be so many.
Boy, is he strict.
Gotta get in there close and find out what's happening.
There's our ticket.
Hey, boys! Look what I got here!
Hey, where are the white women at?
I like that.
Be ready to attack Rock Ridge at noon tomorrow. Here's your badge.
Badges? We don't need no stinking badges. Oh, no!
Qualifications?
Stampeding cattle.
That's not much of a crime.
Through the Vatican?
Kinky. Sign here.
Oh. Why, rat! How many times have I told you to wash up after weekly cross-burning? See, it's coming off.
And now, for my next impression, Jesse Owens.
Seize them! Catch them! Catch them!
Hold up, men! We'll head them off at the pass!
Head them off at the pass? I hate that cliché.
What you...
Say hello.
Hello.
Listen to me and listen to me good. I want you to get all the brothers together. Round up all the lumber, canvas, paint, and nails you can lay your hands on. Mm-hmm. And meet me tonight, 3 miles due east of Rock Ridge. At midnight. You understand?
Mm-hmm.
Say goodbye.
Goodbye.
Thanks a lot, brother.
All right, folks, I know you're a bit confused, wondering what you're doing out in the middle of the prairie in the middle of the night.
You bet your ass!
I'm here. Now, before the sun comes up, we're going to build on this site an exact replica of the town of Rock Ridge. Every building, every storefront, every rock, and every tree. Right down to the orange roof on Howard Johnson's outhouse.
I get it. And tomorrow, when Hedley Lamarr and his men come riding in to destroy the real Rock Ridge, they'll actually be destroying the fake Rock Ridge. But they'll think that it's the real Rock Ridge, but we'll know that it's the fake Rock Ridge.
How are we going to do it? We ain't got the time and we ain't got the people.
Wrong. There's why.
Who the hell are they?
railroad workers. They've agreed to help us make our dream come true. And all they ask in return is a little plot of land they can call their own, the homestead. Now, what do you say?
All right. We'll give some land to the niggers and the Chinks. But we don't want the Irish. No, no, no.
Everybody.
No deal.
Oh, prairie shit. Everybody.
Hold on. Do we have the strength to carry on this mighty task in one night? Or are we just jerking off?
Amen.
Okay, we have done it. Now let's see what we have done. About to embark on a great crusade to stamp out runaway decency in the West. Now you will only be risking your lives, whilst I will be risking an almost certain Academy Award nomination for Best Supporting Actor. Now raise your right hand for the pledge. Right! Now repeat after me. I. Your name?
Your name.
Schmucks. Pledge allegiance.
Pledge allegiance.
To Hedley Lamarr.
To Hedley Lamarr.
That's Hedley.
Hedley.
And to the evil.
And to the evil.
For which he stands.
For which he stands.
Now go to that voodoo that you do. So all the happiness, we are in trouble. Yep, we forgot one little detail.
Nothing's missing. Everything's here down to the last hitching post.
People. There's no people.
Hey, no, don't panic. We just made a perfect copy of Rock Ridge. Now, all we got to do is make perfect copies of ourselves.
But they'll be here in half an hour.
Right, so we got to start working fast. Now, you men start working on the dummies. Jim and Mongo, come with me. I got an idea that'll slow them down to a crawl.
All right, let's go. All right,
come on. You guys, slow down. Come on.
Yeah, that's nice. That's nice.
Oh! The better man flew away. Now, what'll that asshole think of next? Is anybody got a dime?
I don't have a dime.
Somebody's got to go back and get a shitload of dimes. Hurry up, speed it up, or we ain't ever going to get to Rock Ridge. Come on, move him through. God,
well, they're through the toll booth.
Look at this. They're buying it.
here we go. Hold your ears, folks.
It's showtime.
Nothing. What are we going to do? Any minute now, they're going to discover that the town is fake and pull out.
Jim, baby, you think you could squeeze off a little shot from here and set off the dynamite down there?
I'll give it a try.
Oh, Lord, keep this man's eye keen and may God grant...
Watch me. It's so simple, you sissy Marys. Give me the playback and watch me sang it.
Throw out your hands, stick out your push, hand on your hips, give them a push. You'll be surprised, you're doing the French mistake. Voila!
Shit. Have you got it?
Yes.
Sounds like steam escaping. Action! Okay, wait till I get out. Wait till I get out. Okay. Play back.
Throw out your hands. Stick out your push. Hand on your hips. Give them a push.
This is a closed set.
Piss on you. I'm working for Mel Brooks.
Not in the face. Thank you.
That's it, buddy. Come on, girls.
Parked over by the commissary.
Days you have left, Joey?
They lose me right after the bunker scene.
What the hell is that?
Get your pies for the great pie fight.
This is our studio commissary, where some Hollywood stars come to eat. Keep in line. And now we'll go to the special effects department.
Yankee bean soup, coleslaw, and tuna surprise.
Drop your beats. One, please. Student?
Are you kidding?
Pain in the ass.
Look, Herman, I'm in Hedy Lamarr's shoes.
Hedley. Raisinets?
Sorry.
Shit. Freeze it.
Okay, Lamarr. Go be a gun.
Wait. I'm unarmed.
All right. We'll settle it like men. With our fists.
Sorry, I just remembered. I am armed. How did he do such fantastic stunts with such little feet?
Wow, you shot the bad guy.
Well, what do you want to do now?
Come on, let's check out the end of the play.
Yeah. Gee, I sure hope there's a happy ending. I love a happy ending.
Sheriff, you can't go now. We need you.
The work here is done. I'm needed elsewhere now. I'm needed wherever outlaws rule the West. Wherever innocent women and children are afraid to walk the streets. Wherever a man cannot live in simple dignity. And wherever a people cry out. Justice.
Bullshit!
All right, you caught me. Speak the plain truth. It's getting pretty damn dull around here.
Good luck, Bart, and God bless you. Oh, Bart! Goodbye, baby, bro.
Keep the faith, brothers!
You're saying right.
headed, cowboy?
Nowhere special.
Nowhere special. I always wanted to go there.
Come on.